podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Four goal Cole. Hello and welcome to episode 27 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes, we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League over the past few days, while in addition to that, there are also some objectivities that have caught our eye and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible week of football, and this week it's two up top. That means leading the line and wearing the captain's armband is Carl. So Carl, how have you been since we last spoke?
Yeah, really good. Thanks, Dan. Football aside, because it hasn't been a great weekend for all of us on here. But looking forward for some therapy and going through it all.
Top man. Also joining us is Liverpool fan Stuart. Stuart, how have you been these past few days?
Football? What? I thought we were going to talk about the idea that Keanu Reeves is going to reinvigorate the Sonic the Hedgehog franchise. Football. This is news to me. But yeah, I think just to repeat what Carl said, good. Otherwise, football, we're about to have a therapy session.
You are indeed. But as long as you're both good, I'm good, that's all fine. So let's get down to business. Before we do, though, let's do the social media bits. Otherwise, we'll be talking into the abyss once more. So first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at DanTracy1983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is at RealFootballPod. And if you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club. Talking of clubs, I'm delighted to announce we're now part of the UK's first ever sports podcast network, that being Sports Social. Check out the URL and all the links posted throughout the week on the Real Football Pod account. You can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if you like us, leave a review so we move up the league table. Also, the easiest way to find all the links is by going to linktree.com/realfootballcast. But adopting the R and the E, you get 10 podcast platforms to choose from. It's never been easier to listen to this show. Right then, it's time to go live. And where should we go? Well, we'll talk all things title race in a moment. We should probably head back to Monday night first and Chelsea's 6-0 win over Everton. So Cole Palmer goes joint top of the Premier League scoring charts with 20 goals. Do you reckon there's space for him on the England Euro plate?
I think there has to be, Dan, to be honest. But, you know, when you look at the season he's had and the quality that he's got, you know, I know, obviously, you know, you can draw comparisons to me towards him and Phil Foden. But I kind of think at the moment, you know, when you're looking at spaces there, you know, you've got Jack Grealish, who hasn't had the best of seasons by far. So, you know, he was our great hope, wasn't he, in the Euros. But he's kind of stagnated a little bit at the moment. But if you were sort of in a fight between him and, say, someone like Cole Palmer at the moment, you'd probably have to say Cole Palmer would get my nod, because I think he's got an eye for goal, clearly. His quality and his creative side to his game and his passing is phenomenal. And I can only imagine that Pep might be sitting there now thinking, I might have actually let probably, you know, a real good player slip through my fingers here, and he might actually be regretting letting him go.
Certainly. I mean, what, 20 goals already this season, 9 assists to his name as well, Stuart. There is a growing chance that the former Man City man wins both the Golden Boot and also tops the assist charts at the end of the season. And to do that, that would be very lofty company, the likes of Henry, Cristiano Ronaldo. So, you know, we're talking some top-tier names that have done it in the past. If we focus on just the Golden Boot, you look at him being joint top scorer at the moment, his penchant for penalties that we'll get to more in detail in a moment. Do you reckon the Golden Boot award is now in reach for Cole Palmer?
I think it is, because, and I, like, you know, when certain players have certain milestones and you watch the game and it's you trying to get them a goal, and I don't think it's quite to that sort of charitable, oh, we'll just get it over the line, you know, like a Joe Gomez type. Whenever he scores, it's going to be like kick off and that. Cole Palmer's better than that. Chelsea aren't. And the key thing for between now and the end of the season is, I'm not saying it's going to change their prospects in the summer or going forward, but if they have the Golden Boot winner in their possession, and if he does actually go over the line in that, you know, fans need anything. Like, it's not clutching at straws, because if you've done that in a Premier League, in any Premier League, you know, you're not a complete non-entity. And I think in terms of him going to England, he's actually going to benefit from being a non-entity, because I don't think Southside is going to go anywhere near it. But going forward, if Chelsea can sort of get Cole Palmer over the line and then he doesn't have the, oh, he's the scapegoat during the international tournament on him, because I don't think he's going to go on the pitch enough to have that. Could come down to penalties, hopefully. Well, he's a very good penalty taker, so, you know, it might work in his favour. But I think all of the tick points for the next 18 months are going to be like, if you're thinking the Cole Palmer stock is high now, I think it's going to get higher, and I think it's definitely still time to buy in, and he can go on to not necessarily a better performance, but certainly a better aesthetic in terms of his value and what. I think Carl just mentioned it earlier, the idea that Man City are really regretting it. I think that's going to get worse in the next sort of 18 to 12 months because there's no, because of how low Chelsea are, the only way is up for him, and it only really turns negative if they're this bad this time next year. For now, it's just a case of just let him fill his boots.
Yeah, I mean, for all of Chelsea's investment or splurging of money, should we say, over the past, 12, 18 months, that 45 million or so they spent on Cole Palmer looks like the only real the real good bit of business that they've had in the past Todd Bowley era. But also, there's two schools of thought that you're kind of both right in the sense that Carl says Cole Palmer has to be on the plane, and you look at the numbers, you think, well, yeah, he has to. But then there's Gareth Southgate, and he didn't even use him in the March international window. So you're kind of thinking, has he done enough? If he keeps scoring, I don't know, another 5-6 goals between now and the end of the season, surely he's got to be on the plane. But Southgate has his favourites, and who knows, he might not make it, or he might not get as many minutes as Stuart says. Let's go back to penalties, though, because Palmer has scored, I believe, 9 from the spot. So 20 of his goals, 9 of them are penalties. That's 11 non-penalty goals, but there's all kinds of furore last night as 3 players tried to take a penalty from 12 yards, that being Nonny Madueke, Nicholas Jackson and Palmer himself. Now, Carl, some say at Chelsea there's no designated penalty taker. Palmer, of course, hasn't even missed a penalty for Chelsea, so surely these other two players should know better, knowing they've got a red-hot penalty taker in the mix, regardless of him scoring a hat-trick, just let him get on with it.
Yeah, it's that age-old thing, isn't it, when you see these sorts of fights and you just say, listen, you know, we have got a guy here who, you know, whether Chelsea say there's no designated penalty taker, we all know if that game was 0-0, we all know who's taking that penalty for Chelsea, don't we? So it's one of those annoying things that I think as a manager, you kind of go, it makes us look embarrassing. It's not the sort of scenes we want to see, because that has taken kind of a little bit of gloss off of a really good win for them. And ultimately, you just have to get on top of that in the dressing room and say, right, listen, from now on, lads, this guy takes penalties. So when we get one, he's taking them. No one else, you know, if he's on the pitch, he's taking these penalties. And I don't want to see none of that in the future. You know, I always remember, Dan, sometimes there was this discussion with Harry Kane, wasn't it, the year that Son was going for the golden boot, and like, oh, should Harry Kane let Son start taking penalties, that it might just help him get over the line? And you have to go, listen, we're not messing about with that. We want to win games, and ultimately we've got a guy who doesn't let us down from the spot. So when there is a penalty, we let him take it. We get the goal, almost like the guaranteed goal almost with the way these guys take them, and we move on. Embarrassing look, really. And like I say, just took a little bit of gloss off. And you don't take the ball away from a guy who's good as Cole Palmer is from the spot.
You certainly don't. At the same time, Stuart, Mauricio Pochettino said that he cannot accept the penalty row. Now, you look at this and think, I think Cole just touched it there, that should Pochettino be putting more authority on the situation? Obviously, you can't really do much when it's unfolding, but it shouldn't really be a debate to start with. You know, everyone should know Cole Palmer is a penalty taker. He has the ball. Just go away. You know, that's not really something that should be unfolding. Does it also suggest that this Chelsea team is nothing more than a group of superstars and there's no team ethos there yet?
I think, first of all, I don't think I've ever seen a clearer example of a team going 5-0 up, and yet it explains why they are where they are. Because I don't think it's necessarily, and again, like you think of all the hierarchy, the unwritten rules of football and this and that, and there might have been a scenario where Palmer would have been like, you know what, I'll hand it off to someone else. It happened. But in that scenario, all it does is it emphasises the not necessarily the superstar nature of Chelsea and the fractured nature, and they're not a team, they're a group of individuals. But they're a group of quite young individuals. And I think the struggle for Pochettino is I don't know if he has still in his locker the ability not to just get these players together and make them shine and polish the diamonds, as it were. But there's so many like players of a certain age profile and a certain talent profile that you think it needs a very specific manager, or maybe it needs one or two players of a very different kind of maturity. Look, I can imagine, for example, if Milner was playing for Chelsea yesterday, how that would have gone down. I don't think anyone would have got near it. And maybe that's just me overemphasising an older head in cooler times. And it's just, they're already formed up. So I do kind of, to a certain degree, get it. It's not the end of the world, especially if you don't have a specific penalty taker, which I actually do think, as Cole sort of alluded to, there is a hierarchy to this. Whether it's written or not, we know what it is. But I think because they're so young and because they're so... In a sense, you would say, oh, this is a good thing. They really want to, even at a 5-0, even at a game when it's done, they want to try and do something. They want to try and contribute. But at the same time, you just go, this is what's going to hurt you in the future, because you're not creating those bonds and you're not being led. You're just sort of being meandering, and you know, you can have all the talent in the world, and if you're just sort of fighting with each other, then you know, that's where at your best, when you win a game like this, you shouldn't be coming off it thinking, oh well, I can see where the fractures lie within that team. And that is a little bit what I saw yesterday. And so yeah, great 3 points, great victory, probably says more about the opposition than it does the home side, but at the same time, there is a talent pool there, and it just needs to be marshalled correctly.
Now, then again, if it is a bunch of superstars, Cole Palmer's efforts alone really have thrust Chelsea right back into the European mix. With a game in hand over Manchester United, a top seven finish is back in the Blues' hands. And Cole, that's not something we would have entertained even a few weeks ago.
No, and I think that kind of tells you a little bit more about the teams that are above them right now than actually Chelsea themselves, isn't it? And the fact that no one seems to want to take control of that race for top four or the top sort of six and seven. And ultimately, by those teams dropping points as often as they have, it's allowed Chelsea to kind of get themselves back in the mix. And as you say, Dan, quite rightly, you know, a strong run to the end of the season now from Chelsea, and you could well see them get themselves up to possibly be in that fight for sixth or seventh. You know, obviously that race for probably fifth and fourth is well beyond them, but certainly they'll give those teams a run for their money if they carry on playing that way. I guess the trouble for Chelsea is, you know, we've seen they've got failings, and whether those failings, when they start playing possibly more organised teams and better sides, show themselves again. But they're in there with the fight. You know, you can definitely see them finishing above West Ham. You know, got a couple of games in hand on West Ham already and only a point away from them. So they're definitely within their sights. It's just up to whether Newcastle and United can get themselves in gear and kind of keep Chelsea below them right now.
Yeah, I mean, they're in the mix, and that's all they can ask for after a really indifferent two-thirds of the season. They are starting to click. Whether it leads to FA Cup success at the weekend, who knows? But, Stuart, Everton, we can't ignore their aberration of a performance. With that defeat, it's 1-15 for Sean Dyche's men. They host Nottingham Forest on Saturday. That ticks all the boxes in terms of a relegation six-pointer.
Oh, absolutely. And I think no one would have said or accused Everton of going into Stamford Bridge and saying that, like, okay, you have to get this win. But it's the nature of the defeat, and the way that when you're not looking forward, you're looking backward, and a 6-0 hammering really does set the table for the weekend. And a Forest side that, you know, they need to settle it themselves. And Goodison is not one of those grounds where you know, it can be, and it has been in previous seasons, raucous and literally got the team over the line. But all Forest would need really is an entryway into this game. If someone makes a mistake, if they go 1-0 up early, if they can keep a clean sheet to like the 30, 40 minute mark, it will get more tense and it will get more intense. And then, you know, it's a fascinating contest for both sides. And you just wonder whether, like, because there's a couple of games left to play after this, it's not the be all and end all. It's not like this is a six pointer, but it's not. This is the death knell for either sides that would, and maybe that will turn it into a damp squib of a game and it just peters out into a draw. But you feel like there's so much there for both sides that like Everton have to have a reaction. And if Forest can ride those initial waves out, then, you know, they could be in real trouble here.
Right, let's go from the battle to avoid the drop to the battle to stay top, and a battle that saw both Liverpool and Arsenal lose on Sunday. Neither were in the script, if we're being honest. Let's go to Anfield first. Carl, you'd have to say that Palace's winner was incredibly well worked, and Eberechi's Eze finish was the cherry on top.
Yeah, I mean, from a Palace point of view, Dan, that was a well-worked goal, wasn't it? And a good finish from, obviously, you know, one of Palace's sort of like main superstar players, and a player that you kind of feel they might struggle to hold on come the end of the season, because I'm sure there are bigger teams potentially eyeing someone like him up. But it was a great team goal. You know, you couldn't take that away from them. But we did say last week, or, you know, that there might be some surprises coming in this title running just yet. I don't think, when you looked at those fixtures, I didn't expect it to come in this game, though, if I'm being honest. So, yeah. You have to give Palace full credit for hanging in there and getting that massive win for them.
Now, Stuart, that defeat in the league follows the disastrous defeat in the Europa League just 72 hours or more before. If we wind it back to the Manchester United draw the week before that, does it all stem from that stalemate at Old Trafford, or are these three underwhelming performances in isolation of each other?
I could, if I want. I mean, football fans can, you can't, it's impossible to draw conclusions, and we love to do it before the end. And I think the easiest way to go about this is, if we're talking about a season, if it were a football game, we've gone 1-0 down in the 70th minute, and if we end up losing this and going to the point at the end of this metaphorical game and lose 1-0, then all the talk will be about what happened to create that goal and lose the game. If we win it 2-1 and if we turn it round, then, you know, that it's insignificant. There's a little bit too much left to play. I would run it back further and I would say I think the League Cup final is a little bit of a, not just a sigh of relief, but just such an emotional outpouring because of the circumstances and the players that we had available. And you run that through to the Man United game in the FA Cup and how much we were in control and how much, like, that victory would have carried the momentum forward, and it knocks us. And I think both in the game at Old Trafford in the league last Sunday and in the two games that followed, you've seen a side that is running out of steam. And there is a potential that they could pick up that steam very quickly again and do the impossible in Italy on Thursday. And all you have to do is, because we've got a bit of a break, we've got Fulham away, West Ham away and Everton away in between those. So I mentioned about the Forest game, the Everton's game after that is hosting Liverpool. So there is, there's a gap. So it's not immediately afterwards, but there's so much left that right now it looks bad. And right now we look spent. I do think that in 2 weeks, there is a possibility that there could be, because, yeah, okay, we do look like we need a bit of an injection, but that we're getting that injection in terms of returning players. Salah, the weekend and previously, hasn't quite looked on the pace since his return. It's his first major injury and he's not looked great, but just give him a bit more time is what I would say. Trent, same. And Robertson needs a bit more time. I think he's looked the better of those that have returned, but just, and Alisson as well. And because you've had so many people out and we've been relying on kids for so long, it's not a surprise that the ones that have been there for the whole time look just completely their race has run. And I'm just thinking, like, and this is me clutching at straws, and this is the optimist in me. Give it a couple of weeks. Hopefully people can get back to full fitness, and then we'll see where we are. Because if this is to be the end of it, if this is to be the story that's told, then fine. I don't like it, but fine. But I do think there's a little bit left.
Now then, Carl, we've just given praise to Eberechi with his winning goal. I think we've also got to give praise at the other end of the pitch, because as much as Liverpool attempted to blow the house down on Sunday, Palace keeper Dean Henderson was equal to everything that was fired in his direction.
Yeah, it's one of them games as a goalkeeper, isn't it? I think, you know, the good thing is, as a goalkeeper in that sort of game, you go into it knowing that you're going to be busy, but you can come out looking a hero. And if it goes the other way and you concede four or five, you kind of actually sit in there going, well, I don't actually look too bad, because no one expected us to come out of this with a result. So it doesn't reflect too badly on me as the keeper. But he had one of them games, Dan. I've seen numerous goalkeepers down the years at White Hart Lane come and turn in that sort of performance. And you just have to scratch your head. But it's the joy of football, isn't it? You know, you can get a goalkeeper who just has one of those days where you can just tell, you know, nothing's going to beat this guy today. And that's the sort of thing that Palace need if they're going to get those sort of results on those days.
I think every goalkeeping performance which is heroic is always measured on the Tim Krul scale, that being at White Hart Lane, where he just saved everything. So I think, you know, Dean Henderson was up there, but, you know, you've got to credit him. I think also Adam Wharton in the middle of the park, the signing from Blackburn, has been sensational, really. Just kind of makes the easy things look easy and the difficult things look even easier at the moment. He's just, what, 18 years old? He looks like an astute signing for Palace, and I think he'll flourish under the tutelage of Oliver Glasner. But anyway, Stuart, I mentioned the Europa League. I think you touched on it just a moment ago as well. In your eyes, if you were Mr. Klopp, how do you approach the second leg? Are you going to attempt it as one of those famous European nights, or do you quietly let this one go and think, right, all the eggs are now in the Premier League basket?
I think because of the gap as well, you can't really just rest everyone, because you're not really resting people for something. If we had the FA Cup semi-final at the weekend, then I think there's a bigger argument to be made for that. But even then, Klopp has tended to go a lot stronger in the Europa League, which is actually kind of ironic given what happened in the first leg, where I was convinced he was playing Salah and I was convinced he was playing a couple of other people that he didn't. I think you go as strong as you can and you see, primarily because the nature of football. And again, Atalanta do the 3-0 at Anfield, and then in the Serie A, they go 2-0 up against, I think it's bottom of the league in Serie A. The actual identity of the team escapes me, but they go 2-0 up and they end up drawing 2-2. I wonder whether the game plan, it's not quite Barcelona, but it's got to be the same as, you just get one and see what happens and try and get into half-time at 1-0, get a second and then go from there. Our ability to keep a clean sheet does worry me. And the idea of trying to come back from 4-1 down, not for 4-0 down, would kill the tie entirely. But I would go as strong as you can. And not least of all, because after the week we've had, we need a bit of a lift. If we, like, I'm giving away my age here, but there was a, like, year on year of Liverpool would play a PSG, I remember, Strasbourg, I remember, in the UEFA Cup and the Cup Winners' Cup, as it was. And we'd lose the first leg, like, 3-0. And then we'd win the second leg, 2-0. And a second goal would come with like 10 minutes to go, and you think, can we make this comeback? I think if you put that scenario in front of this Liverpool side, there is a suggestion that, you know, they probably might actually be able to bridge that gap and fully complete the comeback. What I would say is that if we go to Atalanta and win 2-0, it'll be frustrating and everyone will go, well, we fucked this in the first leg. And no one's going to be happy, but at least to give you a bit of a boost going forward for the rest of the campaign.
Yeah, I think you're right in the sense the first goal is going to be vital in Bergamo. If you get it, game on. If you don't, obviously, then it's a Herculean task. It has been done in the past, but I think it might be too big a task if Atalanta go 1-0 up. Of course, Cole, Arsenal are going to have their own dilemma when it comes to the balance of Europe and domestic success. And after their Sunday collapse at Aston Villa, they may be better going off and going all out against Munich on Wednesday.
Yeah, again, it's a situation a bit like Liverpool's, isn't it? Where, you know, as I say, we did say there'd be twists and turns. Again, I sit there looking at the fixtures thinking I wasn't so sure that that twist might come in this game with Arsenal being at home. But then you also have to look and think, you know, they didn't manage to get that win over the line against Bayern in the week, you know, conceded two goals where people seem to think their defence is strong at the moment. And I think that all that sort of does is just start bringing in a little, you know, element of doubt. And I think the longer that game was going, you kind of got the feeling that, well, listen, you know, this isn't good. And, you know, you can kind of feel those games turning away from you. And I think that's what started, you know, a lot of the Arsenal fans were starting to get frustrated. And you could sense, listen, this could turn ugly in a minute. Full credit to Villa, because they turned up. No one really gave them a chance. You know, you never know what you're going to get from Villa. They can either be really good or really poor, as we've seen this season. But, you know, you have to give them credit. They stuck in and then they took advantage when the moment was there. And, you know, the second goal from Watkins is a brilliant goal and obviously just kills Arsenal. And it does now say it really opens this title race up. I don't think the shocks are going to be, you know, I don't think the shocks are finished, but Arsenal really need to bounce back now and make sure that they, you know, they get a win in the next game. Because again, you know, they've got Wolves away next and that's not going to be an easy game, because again, with Wolves, you just never know what you're going to get. They can be really good at times or really poor. And if Arsenal don't get something out of that game, then I think you'll see them just start to lose away. And as well, you know, if Bayern manage to get that win over the line, you could see Arsenal's season just start to peter out and become a bit of a disappointment.
Yeah, it's incredible what a few days difference can make. You know, it only takes two results to go against you, and all of a sudden, first becomes third, becomes nothing in terms of silverware. And it was nothing on Sunday for Arsenal, Stuart. And I think really, as Cole alluded to there, there's a sort of sense of rope-a-dope, if you like your boxing references, with Muhammad Ali, that Villa soaked and soaked up everything and then hit them with a 1-2 punch at the end. But I just want to focus on a pivotal 60 seconds or so in the first half. Ollie Watkins hit the post and you thought, oh, maybe Arsenal... Well, Arsenal's luck was certainly in then. A minute or so later, Emi Martinez makes a stupendous save, and really, any other goalkeeper's not making that save. That's it in a microcosm. Was that a sense for you of actually Arsenal's luck might not be in today?
There are instances in games that you just go, oh, okay. Because, and again, like the 90 minutes that I'd watched beforehand was very much a case of like, even in the 80th minute, you think you get one, you get two. But for Arsenal, and in a game like this where they've just watched one of their title rivals lose at home, the pressure then becomes multiplied. And it's not necessarily that the game was won or lost there, but it is the moment probably where the mentality goes from we've got this to do we have this? And if Arsenal, and again, like football fans the world over, doesn't matter what league you're in, I was fully expecting Arsenal not only to win that game, but like to go 1-0 up in the first 5 minutes just to compound my misery. But the longer that game went, as Carl mentioned, the more you thought, oh, Villa have got a chance here. And Martinez is that kind of goalkeeper. And Emery as well, with his history with Arsenal, Martinez, doubly so. There was enough crumbs there to make you think, oh, well, Arsenal need to handle their business here, because if they don't, and the longer this goes, it's not even necessarily a rope-a-dope. It's just sort of the inevitability of the rule of football, which is, You can have as many chances as you want. If you don't take them, then, you know, you're going to get done at the other end. And Villa are too good of a side. It's funny as well, because I spoke to a friend of mine who supports Villa before the game, and their priorities were very much not this game. He was saying to me, like, we might even end up doing what we did against Man City and just play the reserves, because we've got our eyes on Lille. And I don't know if Arsenal necessarily had their eyes further on Bayern than Villa had on Lille, but you know, they're a dangerous side, and if you don't put them to the sword, and it was a good say, look, it's Martinez, that's what he's there for, and that's why he has the reputation he has. It's just simply a good side. If you don't put them away, they will eventually, and the Premier League is full of this. If you have chances and you don't kill them, they'll eventually be able to wound you, and this might, in terms of the title race, be like a mortal wound for Arsenal.
Well, Arsenal didn't take their chances. Gabriel Jesus was guilty of not putting away many. So, Cole, last week we spoke about Kai Havertz being potentially the Arsenal number nine answer in their ongoing question to solve it. But we saw him play midfield instead. So if Mikel Arteta is trying to answer the question with Gabriel Jesus instead, that performance from the Brazilian, and maybe the team as itself, highlighted more of a backward step in trying to find this overall replacement for, well, I don't know who, I guess Aubameyang, really, it's just ongoing, but we kind of get to the point where you try and play Jesus and Havertz together, that's not the answer either.
Yeah, and I think the one thing that's been answered for Arsenal this season is that they actually need to go out and get themselves a clinical striker in the summer, because I do think that ultimately that will possibly be the thing that could hold them back from winning anything this season. You know, I think we've seen enough of Jesus to know that he can be a great player, you know, and he does have his moments, but those moments don't come along often enough. They're not going to probably score you 20, 25 goals in a season. And if you want to be winning the title, as City have shown and as Pep has seen, you actually need to go out and get someone up top who, you know, if you create the chances, is going to score you those sort of like 25, 30 goals a season that just get you over the line and make a title push, you know, a lot more comfortable than it can be. You know, you can share the goals around quite often, you know, and some teams are really good at sharing the goals around. But I think most successful teams, when you look at them, have had a guy up front who's banging in goals regularly and consistently that you can actually rely on. And, you know, I think they've been trying to get by. But I think if you're Arteta, even probably a couple of weeks ago, you're sitting there saying, we need to be scouring the market right now and identifying this striker that we can get in the summer, that probably then you'd have to be worried puts them really aside that you would say, well, yeah, this is a team that could easily win the title.
Now, it was another blank for Bukayo Saka, Stuart. And once again, we saw that same limp on show late in the game. We saw it against Man City recently. What do you make of this? It's been picked up on social media. Is it a coincidence, or is it him trying to take the heat off a performance where he hasn't done the business once again?
One of the few things that like makes me feel like I'm not completely ready to be taken round the sheds and shot is that I used to do this when I was younger. And I feel like it's always been a thing of like, if you have a chance, or if you watch a striker have a chance and they shank it or it goes massively astray, they'll always immediately grab the hamstring. And I don't know if Saka is taking this to the nth degree, but it does feel like, unfortunately for him, whether his physiology is such that he is really struggling, or, and again, because like these players, like they have really run into the ground with minutes, but the problem now is that it appears to be a thing that people are looking for. So he's either going to have a really good game, or he's going to have a game where maybe he is struggling and then he's going to have to get through it. So I feel like, and it's a strange one with Arsenal as well, because when they were on the up and up over the last, say, 2 to 3 years prior to this, since Emery's came in, maybe a little Emery, talking about the past there, since Arteta has come in, and maybe a little bit before that, you wonder, well, there's no wonder about it. He's been their star man. They call him the star boy. And now that they're at that level, you're looking to him to push you over the line. And it might not necessarily be his limits. It might be that they need a little bit more help. I saw an argument on social media the other day about Arsenal need an Alexis Sanchez that could just stick the ball in the back of the net. And I just thought, that's not all he did. He had his fair share of interesting games, shall we say, where he couldn't quite do that. And there is a line to be drawn of, if Saka gets them over the line in terms of winning a title, winning a trophy, he is that guy. But if he can't, then that's not on him alone.
Well, let's focus on Arsenal's North London rivals, Tottenham, because in a week where Aston Villa, or weekend should I say, where Aston Villa did the business, Spurs certainly didn't. They conceded four at Newcastle, and in a lunchtime fixture that was billed as Mickey van der Ven versus Alexander Isak, Carl, there's no doubt that the Swedish forward came out on top on Tyneside.
Yeah, he did. And, you know, I can't criticise van der Ven because I think he's been, you know, our signing of the summer, to be honest. And you've only got to look at him and the way he plays to know that he is a class centre-half. But, yeah, you know, he just had one of those days, didn't he, where, you know, those first two goals, that you kind of people capture those images where you're kind of falling over and looking silly and they'll haunt you for a little while, you know. But he's good enough to come back from that. And, you know, with all due respect to us, if he carries on the trajectory that he's following at the moment, I don't think it'll be long before the top sides in European football will be knocking on his door and probably, you know, take him away from us. But Isak definitely got the better of him. It was a poor day for us and one that I think at the end of it, you know, Ange, I think, has kind of had a lot of credit in the bank this season from Tottenham fans. But I think that result and the performance and the manner of the kind of naivety, I think, that we showed has probably started getting people questioning him and his tactics. And, you know, it just brings up that debate around whether, you know, is the guy ready for this kind of level of football? You know, it was okay doing that in Celtic, you know, with Celtic in Scotland, where you can basically steamroll most sides, but you can't do that in the Premier League. And I think, unfortunately, that result and, the, like I say, the manner of the performance, I think he's going to get a lot of Tottenham supporters asking questions of these tactics at the moment.
Well, I'll stay with you, actually, because I was going to ask about Ange Ball next time, but you've kind of touched on it, so let's move on to it now. As you say, much has been made of it in recent weeks, and you get the signs there's a few grumbles, a few murmurs of, actually, the veneer is starting to slip of Ange Ball, and it's not quite what we were sold it to be. You know, we're kind of sort of seeing these big defeats all of a sudden. So when you look at it, and Ange in particular, what do you make of this almost flat-out refusal to have a plan B? You know, not even entertaining one. This is my football. I'm going to play it how I want. Has the mindset for you, or maybe fans in general, has it shifted from a man who should be commended for sticking to his principles and saying, oh, you know, good for him, that's how we're going to play, brilliant. Has it now gone too much in the direction of he's just being stubborn to his own detriment?
Yeah, I mean, like I say, you know, Ange was a breath of fresh air to us, wasn't he, at the beginning? You know, under the couple of years of Conte and Mourinho, the football was kind of like sit back, you know, soak it all up, try to hit teams on the break that, you know, worked effectively at times, but it was a struggle to get through some games, especially when you're doing that at home against the likes of, you know, no disrespect to them, but Bournemouth and teams like that, where you're thinking, well, listen, I don't want to be sitting just trying to soak up pressure from Bournemouth, and they've got most of the ball for 90 minutes. So when Ange came in with this brand of football, you kind of go, well, yeah, this is what we want to see a bit more, you know, front foot, attacking football. But it does have to be tapered, I think, with a limit of we won't always be able to do that in every single game we go into. And I think as a manager, you do need to have, you know, it's okay having one style of football that you think, well, this is the way I want to play. But I think there are times and grounds that you're going to have to go to in situations where you have to say, right, listen, you know, this probably isn't the time for that right now, and I need to do something, can be a little bit more compromising. And it, you know, it reminds me of, like I say, Dan, the game against Chelsea earlier in the season, where, you know, this was the game that kind of everyone come out saying, well, Spurs are winning at life, because yes, we got stuff 4-1, but we stuck to our principles and, you know, we still went for it. Where ultimately, really, when you look back on that game now, you probably go, with the disarray that Chelsea were in, if you just sat back deep that night and maybe soaked up their pressure, we probably still could have even come away and nicked that game and won it, or at least got a point from it, which it's great to come away saying you're winning at life, but ultimately points on the board is all that matters. So I do think Ange needs to find a way to kind of say, well, yeah, this is the way I want to play. But when I can see that that's not going to work, and we all knew what Newcastle were going to do. They were going to look to hit us with that pace and be, you know, aggressive up front. you can't then play a system where your defenders are almost on the edge of their 6-yard box and, you know, your fullbacks have gone bombing forward and they're not worrying about defending, because you know Newcastle had the ability to hurt us. And when you're saying it's just one long ball over the top that puts you in trouble, that isn't a tactic or a style of play that's going to end up winning you, getting you in contention for winning trophies. So I think it's something he will have to work on. But I still think, you know, first season, no one gave us a hint of being in the top four battle this year. So we just have to hope that if he can, you know, get to the end of the season, possibly top four or fifth at least, and then, you know, have a good strong window where he might be able to bring in some more players that might be able to help this system be a little bit more effective. But the worry is that the goals we're conceding, because I would say it's with probably our strongest back four we've had for a long while.
Yeah, I mean, the likes of Anthony Gordon and Isak had us on toast at the weekend. Scary the amount of pace they had and scary how bad we were at times. But Stuart, with all things considered, it's been a really strange season for Spurs in the fact that, you know, first 10 games unbeaten, top of the league, really indifferent middle periods. We're still fifth, I say we, Spurs fans, we're still fifth with a game in hand over Villa in the race for fourth. But you look at the loss to Chelsea, as Cole mentioned, you look at Saturday, you look at the thrashing at Fulham and Brighton. These substantial beatings, are they ones that Tottenham have to accept if the transformation as a whole is to eventually be completed? Or do they just get panicky and maybe give it another 12 months and think, actually, no, it's not working. A new manager comes in. Do they have to really stick to this and see it through all the way?
Generally speaking, I would say that when it comes to football, and especially a managerial shift or a mentality shift as sort of different as and just brought in, then you have to take the sort of defeats on the chin, as they were. And the teams that you've mentioned, in terms of those heavy defeats, they're not like you've gone to Luton and been absolutely torn to shreds. And I know Luton have played really well in games. And it's not to disparage any side. It's just to say that the defeats you've taken have been kind of individually understandable ones. And it's the thing I said before, which is, if in 3 years, Ange's built a really good culture of attacking football, we play to our principles, we really go for teams, and we have a couple of trophies in the bank, League Cup, an FA Cup, you know, a Europa League, maybe something like that, then you go, oh, that was part of the process. If not, then that's where you look at this and go, oh, we can definitely, if we found flaws in it, in the foundation. And it's unfortunate because you can't really say that a defeat for a manager or a side in the first year where he's barely got his feet under the table is the reason why he shouldn't be given more time. I mean, I think I could argue against my own point talking about Ten Hag, who actually has won things. But what I'm saying is that the ends doesn't really justify the means until you get to the end. And at this point, you, especially when you look around the managerial landscape and you think what else there is out there, you have to sort of take the lumps and hope that things work out in the future. And it sounds really sort of almost like there's no responsibility there, as if, oh, it doesn't matter if we take heavy defeats. No, you should learn from those defeats. And if you're getting beaten in the same way the following season, then yeah, that's when it looks maybe like, okay, well, are we taking anything? Are we learning anything? Are we doing anything differently? But for now, it's just, and especially like with pre-season expectations, post Harry Kane leaving, you know, there is still a very strong potential of Champions League football here, which very few pundits would have ever predicted. And it might not work out like that, but I think as a solid first step forward, and if teams don't move forward in the Premier League, they are dead. And you can tell this is a different step. This is definitely moving somewhere. Whether it works out or not, that's football. But I think for now, there are so many green shoots, there's so many good signs there that, yeah, like, this isn't getting banged. No one likes that. But it's still fine for now in terms of giving me optimism for the future.
Yeah, I think with all things considered, you make great cases, both of you. I think Andrew's still got a lot of credit, and I think you certainly you have to take someone on the chin. We've had 4-0 defeats in the past, Cole, that have really hurt. And I think this one, with the context that Stuart puts in place, almost doesn't hurt as much, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I say, last season was really embarrassing up there, wasn't it? You know, because that game was over. You know, I think I went from my house to the car and we were 3 down all of a sudden by the time I'd opened the car door. So it wasn't as embarrassing as that. And as Stuart says, no one gave us a hint. You know, if you asked any Spurs fan come the start of that first game of the season, having just lost Harry Kane as well, you know, Spurs top four this year, we'd have all laughed and said, you must be joking. You know, if we can be in the top 7-8, that's probably where we are. So we have done better than we thought. And as Stuart said, what we have to hope is that Andy's just kind of learning, sussing these players out, working out where his weaknesses are, where he needs to improve. And he has got, you know, I wouldn't want to see Ange go now. He definitely needs to be given time. But I think a few more heavy defeats come the end of this season, and if he didn't start the season really well next year, then I think we'd see the fan base start, you know, getting a little bit disgruntled and putting some real pressure on very quickly. But let's hope that isn't the case, and, you know, we can just keep moving forward, as we're saying. I think, you know, the trouble for every Spurs fan is you're sitting there thinking, will he get the players that he probably needs to make this success in the summer? And that's where your major doubt comes in.
I think also another problem with the Tottenham fan base, Carl, is that we don't see the bigger picture as Stuart's painted. And if you buy into that, it looks promising. But as we know, it's so instantaneous that for a lot of people, the baby has already been thrown out the bathwater after that 4-0 defeat. You know, it's kind of, we are our own worst enemies at times, because I know we are impatient because we haven't won a trophy since, what, 2008. And there is an element of, you know, you want all of that success that comes, but we're not getting it. And that's where the frustration is. But to kind of ask for Ange out at this stage is kind of beyond ludicrous, really. Anyway, Stuart, I digress, because we do need to touch on Newcastle's point of view. A 4-0 win, no detriment to them in terms of performance. Also, they're back in the top six. And as I said with Chelsea a few weeks back, you wouldn't really put them in the European conversation. You wouldn't really put Newcastle in the Europa League conversation. So it's kind of looking good for Eddie Howe once again.
Yeah, I've often, during the course of this season, referred to Newcastle's struggles as reverting to the mean. They weren't meant to, and meant is in inverted commas, finish in the top four. Just in terms of no side really goes from where they were to where they got to, battling relegation in the Champions League. I mean, it's not quite a Leicester, but it's a significant jump. And then this year, not only were they unfortunate in the hand they were dealt in terms of just an absolute group of death in the Champions League, although there is an argument to be made that that's what you want, especially if you've not played at that level for quite some time. And the other thing as well is the injuries that they've had, and I think this is sort of de facto for pretty much every team across the board, has really forced Eddie Howe into just sort of getting by for quite some time. And there was a good, I can't remember exactly when, whether it was December, January, or slightly later than that, but there was a period of time where you thought, he's going to get the sack here, and they are absolutely on toast. And now you look at it, where they've emerged after that game against Tottenham. They've got to go to Palace, which is going to be a tough tie. But after that, it's Sheffield United and Burnley. And then, they do have to go to Old Trafford. But I don't think there's such a bad run. I look at that and I think they can find their way back into Europe, which I didn't think would be the case earlier on. And whether it's the Conference League or whether it's the Europa League, which they would definitely be hoping for at this point. But for a side that, regardless of what you think about the ownership model, and I have thoughts, but getting into Europe in successive seasons, I said regression to the mean, I think that's still ahead of the schedule. And for them to continue to go forward, and especially if they do need to sell players. And I don't know the ins and outs, and Newcastle fans will complain about the Premier League and this and that, but I think if they do manage to finish in the top six or the top seven and get themselves into a European place for the second season running, they'll probably find it easier, especially with the experience they've got this season. They certainly won't have a harder group. And, well, I mean, it's a 26, 28 team group, even though you only play 10 sides. But still, they're a work in progress. And even though this season has been, quote unquote, a disappointment, in about 2 or 3 years, you might look at it and go, that was valuable experience to get to where we need to get.
Yeah, it could be a slight step back to keep them higher up in the long run. It's funny how football works. It only takes two good results to keep you on top, two bad results, and it all goes wrong. And you could say the same about that for Manchester United. Not bad results because they haven't lost, but they have drawn. They drew at the weekend against Bournemouth, Cole, and they were very lucky not to have lost on the seaside because Tony Harrington once again under the spotlight as the referee this week. He first awards a penalty to Bournemouth after Ryan Christie is fouled. It starts outside the box. It lands, well, you could argue whether it lands inside the box or not. This is the big debate. Eventually, it was called back for a free kick. What would you have done?
Yeah, this was a real... I mean, this is one of those, isn't it? You watch back time and time again thinking, you know, where is that? Because is it on the line? Because, again, if you're sitting there thinking it's on the line, then technically that's a penalty. As you say, he's gone into the box, which then you say, well, it's taken him into the box. And we've seen penalties given like that before, haven't we, in the past, using VAR. So real difficult one, this. I'm not sure. I do just think they've maybe just got it right and that the initial foul was just outside the penalty box. And we are talking by, you know, a fag paper of it just being outside the box. So, yeah, I think they just got it right. But again, you could easily have seen that being a penalty. And like we said last week, what I'd really be interested to see is flip that. If that was United at the other end and that happens to United, Arsenal, City, Liverpool, what decision gets made from that there? And does that big team get the benefit of that at all? But we'll never know that. But, you know, that was a real harsh one. But I do think they just got it right. And the initial foul was just outside the penalty box. But United come away from that game very lucky because Bournemouth had chances and they will feel that was 3 points dropped possibly.
Absolutely. You could also argue, Stuart, that United had luck of their own in terms of a penalty decision when Adam Smith was the judge to have handled the ball. He didn't know too much about it, but did he move his hand too much?
I hate these questions because every week, I'm not sure it's, I remember very vividly thinking that in Spain, I don't even know if this is still the case, that any handball, regardless of whether it's intentional or unintentional, would get a yellow card. And this is an old rule, so if it was scrapped about 5-6 years ago, again, my La Liga refereeing standards aren't quite to what they used to be. But I always remember thinking, like, how do you judge that? And now it feels like we're in a similar situation in the Premier League, where like, there are handballs that are given and you just like, oh, okay, yeah, fine, fair enough. And there are handballs that are not, and you just, oh, okay, I might have. The whole thing boils down to how upset would I be if it was given against us? And again, even on that, kind of 50-50. I don't think that the age-old argument, I would say, is don't make the referee give a decision, because if you do, they probably will not arrive at the right one. So, I feel like this is another one where Howard Webb needs to sit down next to Michael Owen and explain to me in very slow terms, in very short words, exactly why. Because when you watch it, you just go, maybe. But as someone that doesn't want Man United to get a penalty, I'm like, definitely not.
Well, I mean, it's harsh, isn't it? Because you can see there's a bit of a reaction from Smith, but whether it leads to the penalty award, I don't know. If you're a Tottenham fan or a Liverpool fan, you'd be rubbing your hands with glee there. If it goes against you, you'd be absolutely furious. Burnley fans might be furious with Muric in goal because, Carl, that's the second week in a row he's given quite a big error, which has led to Burnley dropping points. A draw against Brighton is a good result, but they need all three, and that might prove the kind of death knell for their survival hopes.
Yeah, you know, the games are running out, aren't they? And the opportunity to get points on the board are very, you know, scarcely to come by for a team like Burnley this season. So when you put yourselves in a position to kind of get those points, you just need everyone to be on the ball and not make the kind of mistake that was made. And it's one of them, you know, we've said over the years, haven't we? You know, you can miss four or five sitters as a striker and everyone forgets about it come the end of the game. But you make one mistake as a goalkeeper and ultimately it's in the back of the net. And everyone's talking about it for the next few days and how it's cost you. And it's hard to recover from that. But, you know, I think ultimately if you're Burnley, you probably have to sit there and say, good point, away from home. So that's now try and take that momentum and build it into our next game. But as you say, yeah, I think they will be disappointed because, you know, right now, if they've got 3 points there, they really put themselves in with a chance of having a decent fight to the end of the season. I don't think they've got a chance of staying up. I think, unfortunately, they're going to go, but that would have given them a real boost.
Yeah, they're now 6 points behind Nottingham Forest, who they meet on the final day of the season, and it's probably going to be done before then. And Stuart, it's another home point for Nuno's men after a 2-2 draw with Wolves. Arguably, should have been 3 for Forest, because for all the goalkeepers on the City Ground books, it's a position they just cannot seem to sort out.
Yeah, I think as well with Forest, and it's going to be interesting with some of the games they've got left to play, because you think points deduction, crowd, are they going to react in a similar way that Everton have reacted in terms of like, can we use this sort of fury? Can we use it, not spitefully, but can we just give it fuel to the fire? And in these home games, especially against sides that don't have a lot, Wolves to a certain degree look completely knackered and not quite on the beach necessarily, but just they have played, they have ran their race. I think I said this earlier. And with Forest, you just think we don't need a lot. We just need enough to get us over the line. And unfortunately for them, there's some positives there, because when you're trying to avoid relegation, you need players with the ability to score goals. And if you don't have that, then you're dead and buried. But unfortunately, they do have that, which is, again, the reason why you're down there in the first place. They cannot stop teams from scoring. And it's just, it must be hugely frustrating every time you get yourself in just an inch in front. That, like, it doesn't take a lot to bring that back. And I do think, based on everything else that's going on down there at the table, they will be fine. But there's going to be at least one game, and they do have Man City to come to the City Ground, so I am, fingers crossed, where they do need to pull it all together, because it's not quite there yet.
Well, I think it's going to be quite there for Brentford, Carl, because they eased to a 2-0 win over Sheffield United. They're now 7 points clear of Luton. They drew 3 games in a row before getting the better of the Blades. A win has been coming. A win should get them over the line now, shouldn't it?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think you'd probably look at a team like Brentford and think they've probably got another win and a couple of draws in them somewhere that I think probably is enough to see them safe and give them another season of Premier League football. But they are a team that can't afford to take their eye off the ball and kind of sit back and just think it will happen. Because, again, you know, they have a couple of defeats in a row now, and Everton and Forest get themselves some points on the board, or Luton, then again, Brentford start looking over their shoulder and being worried. But I think they'll see it through and they'll be safe come the end of the season.
Well, as for Luton, they lost 5-1 to Man City on Saturday. 12 key players were absent for the trip to the Etihad. But as I mentioned last week, it's not really the results against the big teams. It's how they follow up against those teams in and around them. And as luck would have it, Stuart, they face Brentford at home on Saturday.
Yeah, I think the fascinating aspect of how dead and buried everything looks at that bottom end of the table is that before that Brighton equaliser against Burnley, and again, this is why it killed Burnley so badly, is that it comes so quickly after their goal. But you looked at the points, and for like half a second, well, for 3 minutes, there was a route out. And so therefore, for Luton, there is still, like, Luton are nowhere near as dead and buried as Burnley. So therefore, there is still a route out. And this Brentford game, it might not be do or die, because I remember Blackpool back in the day, they sort of scrimped and managed to get to the point at the end of the season where they unfortunately had to go to Old Trafford. And it's not, I think I've said this before in a previous podcast, that Luton's last game of the season is nowhere near as demonstrable as that. They've got Brentford at home, Everton at home, and Fulham at home. I'm not saying they need 9 from 9, because that's how bad this bottom end has been. But like, you've got to just get that momentum early. Like, hurt Brentford and go from there. And the fact that after all this time, there is still a viable route out for them is fascinating and a testament to the way they've played throughout the rest of the season.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like Bradford, when they got to the Premier League and they had that second season after kind of beating the odds first time round. They might be terrible if they do start next time, but at least they're in the mix. And I think credit has to go to Rob Edwards and his players. Credit also goes to Manchester City after their draw in Madrid in midweek, Carl. It's 3-3 from the first leg. They meet again in Manchester in a few days' time. That'll be Wednesday. Are you backing City to do the business, or is this one still in the balance?
Yeah, tough. I mean, it was a bit of a boring game to watch, to be honest, and some really poor goals scored that night, wasn't it? but I think that game is on a knife edge, you know. It is one of those games that with the talent Real Madrid have got, you could see them scoring again. And I think City will have enough to see it through. And especially if they play the way they did against Real Madrid last year at home, where they absolutely tore them apart within the first half. And then the game became a sort of cakewalk towards the end. I think they'll just get it over the line. But I don't think that's a kind of like simple equation of, yeah, that's a done deal. That they'll do enough, it'll be easy, because Madrid could still have a shock in them. And let's face it, Bellingham probably won't play as badly as he did in that first game. So I think they'll do it, but that'll be tight.
Yeah, I think a City win, but both teams scoring, is probably the smart move. But as you say, Real Madrid, you never, ever write them off. You probably write off West Ham after their defeat in Leverkusen in midweek in terms of Europa League success. Stuart, you might also have to write them off in terms of actually a top seven finish after their defeat to Fulham on Sunday.
Yeah, I think the Leverkusen game, understandable, less so the Fulham game, because I mentioned earlier that Wolves might be on the beach through the fact that their squad is just been through the ringer in terms of injuries, whereas Fulham just, they booked their tickets to insert resort here and have been setting camp for quite some time. I don't necessarily, this would be a turn up for the books, but there is a small possibility of after the Lord Mayor show for Leverkusen having won the league that, you know, football creates circumstances. And part of me saying this is only so that I can, in my head, pretend that we have a chance as well. But at the same time, when games and when ties seem dead and buried in the way that they do, there's always room for something like that. And West Ham have been so peculiar all season, just based on league position and the vibe around the club. I think of Moyes is, again, he's never going to be anyone's favourite manager, including a side that actually he's won a European trophy for. So, like, it's a struggle, but it does feel like this might be the time to, at the end of this season, just part ways, and then we'll see what happens. His reputation remains intact, and it's almost a reverse Crystal Palace in a way, and just sort of, we know how this works if you carry on from here. But West Ham, again, it's not quite the same as Tottenham and Harry Kane, but the removal of Declan Rice, you wondered whether they'd be the same type, like have the ability to have the results that they've had, and they've been more or less the same. So, you know, there's still a good talent pool there, and what they do next season is probably going to be dictated to what they do behind the scenes and whether they do move forward with Moyes or not. But it's hard to say that a side finishes as high as they do, gets to the Europa League, however they've done, following on from a cup victory, and it still feels like a disappointment. But that's maybe like the bar that's been set there recently.
Yeah, I think it's kind of almost a victim of your own success. But, you know, West Ham fans, even if David Moyes lived in the Premier League, I think some of them would still be unhappy. That's just the nature of Premier League football as we are today. But anyway, we've hit full time, so I need to part company with my two top guests this week, my two Pod Squad members. Stuart, thanks for your work as always, top work as always, I should say, and I look forward to your next outing.
Always a pleasure, even when the football's terrible.
Cheers, mate. And Carl, thanks for wearing the captain's armband this week. I hope you'll join me next time.
Yeah, looking forward to it, Dan. And, you know, thanks for the free therapy, mate.
Absolutely. Right, cheers, guys, and also to the listeners out there. And with that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast. And until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. Sports Social Podcast Network.